This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Notion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oakland.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, our customary Wednesday evening feature, and ready to roll for the next hour. And Jude, each and every week we have the opportunity to visit with some of the biggest names in thoroughbred racing, and we enjoy hearing their stories, how they got started in the game, the people that helped them along the way. And tonight's show, absolutely no exception, going to be outstanding.
Yeah, we got two guys that are just really first-class people and big names in the game, and looking forward to talking to them.
Trainer Reed Baker going to be with us for the first half of the program, and then David Donk will join us for the second half of the show tonight. We do welcome everybody just joining us on Sirius Channel 93, and for those of you who have been with us for the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage on XM 209, welcome back to the program, and of course a special welcome to everybody joining us around the world on our website, horseracingradio.net. Trainer Reed Baker fast approaching the 1,000 career win milestone, sitting with 963 winners, purse earnings of more than $46 million. Among those 963 winners are more than 100 stakes winners and multiple champions. He is the recipient of Canada's Sovereign Award as top trainer. And for those of you that don't know, that is the equivalent of the Eclipse Award here in the United States, a tremendous honor. And Reed, nice enough to be with us here tonight on Trainer Talk. Reed, thanks for taking the time.
Hello.
Nice to have you with us on Trainer Talk tonight, Reed. How you doing?
All right, fine, thank you. I can barely hear you.
All right, we'll try to bump up that volume a little bit, make it a little bit easier for you. And I mentioned those accolades, and there have been so many tremendous accolades that you've received throughout your career, but it's a career that really started, growing up in, is it Port de Lucie, Ontario? Did I say that right?
Yeah. I got a pony for Christmas one time in the house in a box, and I guess that started it. And then my uncle took me to the races at Fort Erie when I was about 14. I shouldn't have been there. I wasn't old enough to be in the track at that time, but that started my love affair with racing. The pony started my love affair with horses.
Yeah, and I know you credit your uncle as being the person responsible for getting you involved in the sport when he took you to the races there at the age of 14. And it kind of created a bit of an issue for you, at least in school anyways, because of that, you weren't necessarily the best student, if I recall, right?
No, I was a long way from the best student, but I used to at noon when Fort Erie had a spring meet in the old days at noon, instead of going back to school, I would go to the highway, which was only a half mile away, and hitchhike down to Fort Erie. My parents frowned upon that. So obviously they sent me away to a boarding school. The guy on my right, his dad was a thoroughbred trainer, Alex Chris, and the guy on my left, his family owned horses. So I went from the frying pan to the fire.
That's that's quite a story. I can imagine. My mom used to get mad at me for driving to Hollywood Park, but hitchhiking would be a whole different story. Wow.
Well, and it's amazing, Reed, that when you do end up going to boarding school, your parents probably thinking, well, this is going to be for the best. He'll get a good education. He'll be a good student there. And you end up sitting next to two people who had relatives that were in the horse business. They had to be beside themselves.
Yeah, I was hooked. You know, that got me an in to get to the track, but really I was hooked the first time I went there. I saw these guys walking around in these fancy suits, Frank Merrill, beautiful women, and these horses were just gorgeous. And the kicker of it all was all you had to do was walk, take the money. I mean, this is heaven, right?
Right. Yeah, why not? It's easy, right?
they were all like, I could look at the results the next day and I knew I would have had every single winner.
Well, when did you finally make the decision? This was at 14 when you go to the races, but when did you finally make the decision to say, hey, you know what? I want to get involved in the sport. I want to work in the industry.
And I went to the Queen's Plate and watched Northern Dancer with my sister. And so to the and summer holidays in 65, I went to the racetrack and I've been there ever since.
What was your first job on the track?
You know, the first horse I ever touched was a horse called Canberra. It almost started and finished my relationship on the racetrack because he had won the original in Canada and went to stud and wasn't fertile. So the first horse they had me look after, the guy was a famous trainer, Pete McCann. Winfields owned the horse, Mr. Taylor. And a baptism of fire for sure. I had, when he was rearing up in the stall, I had second thoughts, but I thought I'd stick it out.
Wait, you got by that one, and then who else helped you along the way?
Well, you know, I never really had any mentors or teachers per se. I always had people that, you know, anybody that gave you a job was doing you a favor. You just had to keep your mouth shut and your ears open, you know, learn as you go. And I watched guys do it very successfully. I was read the, I guess it was the Times at the time, faithfully. I kept them from right when I was 18 years old. So you'd read about the Charlie Whittinghams and the Woody Stevens and all the things they did to be successful with those horses and take care of young horses to make old horses, and just tried to pile the knowledge together. And then I got a break along the way. A guy named Neil Campbell worked for the Globe and Mail in Toronto, introduced me to a guy named Rick Kennedy. And I'd gone from galloping horses to being a jocks agent. This was my next step. I ended up being a racing manager and managed the fleet. That took me, and he wanted me to be his trainer someday, so I went all over the world watching other people train, Tommy Smith in Australia, Luca Comani in England, and all these different guys, and that was a big thing for me. I picked up a lot there, you know.
Well, I can imagine getting a chance to see all those different operations and different training styles. That has to be a huge benefit to you today as you're working with your operation and training horses, even in the modern day.
Yeah, it's a big thing because you can watch guys. So everybody said this guy or that guy's the greatest trainer. But, you know, Tommy Smith would get up and train all his horses before 6:30 and had the facilities were very, very poor. Not poor, but I mean, His horses were stabled on a lean-to on the side of a school. And he'd get those horses out at 4:30 in the morning and walk them down the street and could only use certain parts of the track to train on. This wasn't Newmarket. This was a whole new world. And he made do. He was leading trainer, I think, in Sydney for 30 out of 33 years or something like that. It's a marvelous thing.
You know, I had read somewhere, Reed, where you had talked about working with Conn Smythe and with that outfit. And you said that you were thrilled to be a groom there, and to this day, it's still the best outfit you've ever seen in Canada.
Yeah, he was a tough little guy. He built Maple Leaf Gardens and started the hockey team in the middle of the Depression.
Wow.
A great war hero. But, horses did anything wrong. Horses would come in and be nervous in the paddock the first time you'd run them, or nervous in the barn. He'd sell the horse that day. He'd say, you know, he's shaking now, he's really going to shake on plate day, and that's what we're here for, plate day. And he drilled into me that you had to have everything there. You had to have the help and the feed and the stabling to take care of good horses, and a good horse would emerge. If you try and run a rinky-dink outfit and have that good horse emerge, he'll never emerge. You know, if you're going to get a better employees for that particular horse, you'll never find that horse. He can't emerge from that.
Talking with trainer Reed Baker on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Interesting stuff there, Reed. And I thought one other thing that I found particularly interesting, and I've said this for a couple of years now when we do our live racing coverage, I introduce Reed Baker as a former lobster delivery man. And people ask me if that's really the case, if you were really delivering lobsters at one point earlier in your career.
Well,
and that is true.
For 25 years, I always had three jobs a day. I would gallop horses in the morning and work in the mutuals in the afternoon. And then I knew a guy I knew from the racetrack had this fish store. So he had to get somebody to get the lobsters from the airport at night when the lobster season and take them to his fish store. So that's what I did. Did whatever you could.
Yeah, a lot of times people don't realize, but working on the racetrack doesn't often pay that much, and you need those little side jobs to pay the bills.
Yeah, that was part of it. The other was, it was just in my learning lessons about how not to gamble. You know, I thought that was a great source of income, so I was probably delivering lobsters for my handicapping lessons. Self-taught.
And you mentioned you were a jocks agent for Gary Stahlbaum at one point. You had a lot of success there. I guess that was in the mid to late 70s. And did you ever give any consideration to remaining on that side of the fence as opposed to going and training horses?
I still do. I still think about it. It was the easiest job I had, and then I loved to do all the work and find the horses and the research. You know, it helped me with my people skills. You know, and I think the big thing was when you went home at night, if you called the jock up and say you're happy, he said, yes, deal done.
Yeah.
Not anymore. Now I've got all kinds of owners and employees and like to make everybody happy, but can't do it.
Yeah, well, it's a lot more cost effective because the books are free and you can steal a pen. So you don't really need a lot to be a jocks agent, but being a trainer, and especially an operation like yours, you've got to have all kinds of equipment and you've got a huge payroll and all of that. It's very expensive.
Yeah, well, yeah, more than the expenses is, you know, you go to bed every night and not everybody's happy. You know, you'd like to make them happy, but it can't happen, right? And these are people that typically have been very, very successful in all their businesses. They don't know anything about this not successful part.
So, Reed, when was it that you finally went out on your own and started your own operation?
You know, I was racing manager for Mr. Kennedy, and we were cutting way down in horses. And we didn't have enough horses to employ a trainer. We had horses all over at one time. So I just kind of took those horses over and inherited them. It wasn't a plan, that's for sure.
What was that, sometime around 1990 or so, right in that ballpark?
Yeah, maybe a couple of years earlier than that, but right around there. So that's all really I've been doing this. I kind of backed into the job, right?
Yeah, and you talked about all your travel all over the world. You also had a brief trip to Dubai that maybe didn't quite go the way you were hoping it was going to go.
Yeah, I went to Dubai. At the time I wrote an article for the Blood Horse. Amazing. I still amazed to this day they would publish it. But, you know, I wrote that article about the Blood Horse, and I saw a vision of what this guy was going to be able to do. But nobody else seemed to have the same vision. They couldn't see it the same thing as I could see.
Well, it certainly developed into one of the great racing venues. One thing you mentioned, all your experience in different businesses and stuff. And one thing that I know you've done that a lot of other trainers don't do is you've been very proactive in, advertising your stable. I was on the newsletter list. You used to send out a newsletter. I don't know if you still do or not, but it was one of the most interesting and innovative things that I ever saw was that newsletter that you published.
Yeah, my wife was really, you know, she did all the work. I put the input into some of the things were said there, but it was a big break for us. It was a great thing, you know. Now you've got to leapfrog 100 miles an hour. So the latest thing, although we're not first on the block with it, is the Facebook. We're big into the Facebook now, you know. I don't know if you can put those things. I mean, I said things there that I certainly, when I said everybody in Lexington said genuflect when Northern Dancer's name was mentioned. That wasn't a big hit.
That didn't go over too well?
No, it didn't go over too well. As I drove around Kentucky the other day, I thought, all these wonderful farms that horse made, you know, where would Walmack be without Nuria, Claiborne, without Nijinsky and Danzig? He had a monumental effect.
Yeah, he was a sensational horse, and you're 100% correct, even though it may not have been a popular statement. But, I missed the old newsletter.
Hey, Reed, has all the social media and the new technology that's come along in recent years, has that changed training horses at all or how you approach the business? I know
no,
you mentioned
I
Facebook.
I avoid that. But... You know, I know I saw a young man in New York one time, and every time a horse would gallop, he'd run back and email the owner, send all these notes and all that stuff. Hot dang, like I think it ruined his career. Like, you know, he's spending more time on the computer than in the shed row. Once you get to that point, you know, you got to be a monster. Some of these guys have the ability to get horses, and they're trained by Pepe 200 miles away and get away with it, but that's not my style. You know, if I can't touch them, then I'm not training them.
Well, the hands-on thing is been a theme lately with a lot of our guests and wanting to keep their operation small enough so they can be hands-on instead of the far-flung operations that a lot of guys have.
Yeah, it's nice to have it that way. The problem is to maintain, because now when you put yourself in that position where you want to touch them, then there's real big guys that overwhelm you with quality and volume. Fletcher in the States, Marcassi in Canada. I mean, those guys, you win one a day and you're really happy, and they win three. So how do you convey that stuff to convey that to a potential owner coming in when those guys are winning all those races?
Yeah, Reed, you mentioned your owners. Talk about a couple of the owners you've had the privilege to be associated with that have really helped you.
Well, you know, every single one, because when they give you a horse, that's a gift. You're just another stick in the mud, right? He gives you that horse, he could choose anybody. So you don't deserve any of them. You're just lucky to get them. You know, in the States, Barry Jones has been very, very good for me. You know, he's been a great asset to the barn. Obviously, in Canada, you know, I've got Bear Stables as my biggest client. He's been a great, great supporter now for 6 years. I get Jim and Susan Hill. I'm going to run their horse, Go Blue or Go Home, opening day at Keeneland. On Thursday night at Presque Isle, I'm going to run Barry Jones's horse, Jose Seaview. Those guys have been very, very important. But every single one that gives you the smallest guy there is, I got a guy that works at the post office that has a part of a horse with me every couple of years. You don't know, maybe you win a race with that guy's horse that day and somebody else is looking, and that's how you get the next guy.
Well, and you have not been shy about making investments with your very own money to upgrade your barn area at Woodbine to do different things to improve on your operation. Talk about that.
Well, that's what Mr. Smythe said. Mr. Smythe said, you've got to have that atmosphere for that great champion to grow up in. So if I have to come up with money or whatever I have to do, whether I have to get it out of the bank or I have to borrow, it doesn't matter. They're going to have the best I can possibly give them. You know, we've got great facilities at Woodbine. We have better training facilities, I think, anybody in North America, with the 1 mile dirt track and 7/8 turf training and 1 mile poly track. I mean, I don't think there's anybody can compare with that in the United States. So we've got great facilities. You know, the problem, American horses are always going to probably beat us, or beat us in most cases, simply because your tax laws, you know, really help the owner, where in Canada ours don't. You take a loss, you take a real loss.
Yeah, you know, the situation in Canada has been in flux for quite a while now. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think we're going in the right direction. You know, certainly we need this party or the next party that gets in to act on all this conversation. We're getting lots of conversation about they realize that no racetrack does it on their own, just like Keeneland does it. with the sales. They live by the sales. The government has to help you out here. We're providing all kinds of jobs for people. They need to do some. So in saying that, when you get this help, now this government has promised that help, but they haven't acted on it. So we got an election coming up. Is somebody going to act here? Somebody needs to do something. And if somebody needs to do something long range, I mean, it's an embarrassment to think that Kentucky, their largest now industry, is poultry rather than horses. I mean, that's asinine. The government needs to step up and help. You know, what about all these employees, all these people paying taxes? You know, they can't just keep taking and taking and taking.
Yeah, well said. Trainer Reed Baker, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fayzid Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Reed, I referenced your Sovereign Award as top trainer. And again, for people here in the United States, that is the equivalent to the Eclipse Award here in the U.S. It's a tremendous honor, the highest honor you can receive in Canadian racing. When that day came and you received that, obviously a very special day for you, but is it somewhat of a vindication of everything you worked so hard for your entire life?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, guy told me when I was a kid, you know, people talk, horses run. That's really a horse award. I don't know how valid those things are. So you get more horses to train, that means you're the best trainer? Somebody actually think they're a better trainer in the United States than Alan Jerkins? I don't think so. I don't think so. So it was nice. It was great for my family. But be really realistic. It's a horse award. Horses ran faster.
Well, speaking of horses, I mentioned the several champions that you've been associated with, have the privilege to train. Talk about some of the career highlights, in your opinion, and some of the moments you're never going to forget.
I guess Fatal Bullet, second in the Breeders' Cup, the Midnight Loot Run, and seven and change. Bear Now winning the Cotillion. But I think the thing we're the proudest of, you know, we have two-year-olds that win sprinters, win long, win, but, you know, the group of horses I've got now, with Fatal Bullet going to run the big stake coming up, 8 years old. Those old horses that we've taken care of are rewarding us. That would be the biggest thing.
Has there ever
them around for a long time.
Has there ever been a horse that you trained that maybe didn't get a lot of public accolades, but you knew you did an unbelievable job with?
Well, I don't know if I did a good job with it. We had a horse called Bear Holiday. A Harlan's Holiday was probably the best two-year-old I was ever around. Ran three times, won easier, farther, faster each time, and then did something to his neck in the stall and never raced again. He could have been a superstar, you know. I guess Kentucky Bear was a really good horse, and I mismanaged him into being a stallion. I didn't play that one very smart. He was a really, really talented horse.
When you talk about some of the other horses like Biofuel and 2ND Way and Judas Wild Rush, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And you talk about keeping them on the track for a long time and how much pride you take in that, Reed. And it has to be very special to see a horse competing at that high level later on in their career.
Yeah, if you take a horse like Biofuel, they come to you, somebody else has broken them, somebody else has raised them. You just kind of do your thing with them. I don't think that's any of that big a deal. She was a very talented horse. She won some money, probably should have won more. Tuwendo Way was a brilliant horse, brilliantly fast horse, won the My Dear first start of her life and ran fast. But I think if you take Judas Wild Rush, who ran for 50,000 claiming for, I got him, and then he was a double Canadian champion, you take more pride in that. But, you know, it's a horse game. There was errors along the way, too.
You know, a lot of people may not realize, Reed, that horses are not your only hobby. You're also very much into showing birds, mainly chickens and ducks. What's easier, training horses or training chickens and ducks?
Well, I win about 90% of the time with the chickens, so I guess it's the chickens.
How'd you get into that?
My father brought some home for me one day when I was like 8 years old, and I've had them most of the years since. I, you know, for a while there I didn't have any, but I'm back in them now. I go up and see them one afternoon a week when I'm up watching the horses train. I have 45 horses at the racetrack, and I have 7 or 8 at a training center. That's just about as many as I ever have. So when I go up to this farm to look at the horses, I take care of the birds. And in the fall, this time of the year, I go up there two or three times and wash them, either for a Canadian show or a big American show. In fact, that's what I'm just about to do in half an hour.
What's involved with that?
Well, you've got a, you know, I've got a partner while I'm lounging in Florida. I got a partner that's hatching them. And then we pick out the 70 or 80 and they come to this training center that I rent some stalls at and raise them. And then it's my idea to, you know, make sure that they don't get damaged or lose any feathers. And then I come in today and I'll wash them and they'll go to a show here in Ontario on Saturday.
What do you look for confirmationally or whatever? I'm sorry.
Well, you know, they were bred same thing as you looked at athletic thing in the horses for 2 weeks I spent at Keeneland. You know, you're looking for, if it's an egg-laying bird, does it have all the things that an egg-laying bird needs? If it's a bird that it was bred originally for meat, does it have all the things that the meat chicken should have? Big enough beak, wide enough head, all those things. And the feathers at this stage got to be perfect. Everything's got to be perfect.
Absolutely amazing. Trainer Reed Baker, Canada's Sovereign Award winner, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Reed, hard to believe we're just about out of time, but do want to say thank you for taking the time to visit with us. It's been amazing to hear your story, and we wish you all the best moving forward. All of our guests who appear on the show are going to receive a gift courtesy of our man, Joey Diamond at EPO Equine. We'll send that to you, and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those in the mail to you.
Thank you very much. And I would like to say that Lexington downtown has improved greatly. They've done a great job down there.
Well, very nice to hear. Yeah, thank you.
Take care. Thank you very much.
Reed Baker, our special guest. Boy, what a fun story.
That's amazing.
The guy's incredible.
I didn't even know they showed chickens.
Yeah. He is absolutely incredible.
He's had an interesting life.
Yeah.
This is what Trainer Talk's all about.
Yeah. Amazing. Started with a pony in a box.
I'm never going to see his name in the form of that thing of the chickens and ducks name.
And a former lobster delivery man.
He loves animals, obviously.
We'll have
right?
to ask David Donk if he ever trained chickens. Coming up in the second half of the show. We'll do that next on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Success at the October sale continues in 2013 with Grade 1 winners Golden Sense and Admiral Kitten. In 5 years, graded success at home and abroad. Two Kentucky Derby winners. Graded stakes winning graduates at North America's most prestigious tracks, including Golden Sense winning the 2013 Grade 1 Santa Anita Derby. With over 1,000 yearlings, the October sale continues to offer outstanding performance and great value. The October sale, Fasig Tipton Lexington. Where will you be?
Now you can help your equine athlete heal faster and recover stronger with Ultras Elite, a wearable low-intensity therapeutic ultrasound system that has been used successfully to treat splints, suspensory ligament and tendon injuries, muscle strains, stiff joints, and bone fractures. Ultras Elite is clinically proven to reduce swelling and inflammation, increase joint flexibility, and reduce pain and irritation. For more information, visit ultras.com. Ultras, heal faster, recover stronger.
I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, makers of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, here in North America, horsemen are protecting their horses with Flair strips. Are the strips benefiting horses in other parts of the world?
Mike, horsemen around the world use the strips to protect lung health. For example, South African horse at the Euro Variety Club regularly races with a strip. In South Africa, many graded stakes, including Grade 1 stakes, have been won in 2013 by horses wearing the strips. In New Zealand, reigning horse at the Euro Mufasa races with a strip, as well as many thoroughbred and standardbred stakes winners in Singapore and Australasia this season.
To learn more, visit flairstrips.com.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
The 2013 Daily Racing Form National Handicapping Championship Tour is off and running with tournaments virtually every week. Last year's NHC and Tour had total prize money of nearly $1.8 million. Jim Bennis, a horse player from Chicago, Illinois, landed the grand prize of $750,000, an Eclipse Award, and the title Handicapper of the Year. Find out more by visiting nhctour.com and join the tour today to begin your quest for the NHC in January 2014 in Las Vegas.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasic Tipton.
Mike Penna, Jude Fell, back with you on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Fun visit with trainer Reed Baker, an amazing story in the first half of the program, and looking forward to our next special guest, trainer David Dunk, coming up in just a moment. But JT, want to remind our listeners that they can check out the Fasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearling Sale coming up on September 30th. Will not want to miss this one. 390 yearlings by 157 different sires. And, you know, the Fasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic Sale, and Jude, you and I have talked about this at several different occasions, it's really been a place for a long time to buy quality yearlings, and you get to do it in that tradition-rich Mid-Atlantic region. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a very good sale, and lots of nice horses come out of that sale. People in Maryland raise good racehorses, and it's definitely worth going to.
Grade 1 Spinaway winner So Many Ways, Grade 2 Delaware Oaks winner Dancing a Fleet, and Grade 2 Brooklyn Handicap winner Redeemed, all graduates of that Fasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearling Sale. Make sure you are there on September 30th. Trainer David Dunk with us now on Trainer Talk, and David, the trainer of 525 career winners, purse earnings of more than $25 million, and he was introduced to racing, like so many other trainers that we've had the opportunity to talk with on this show, by his father. David, welcome to the show.
Gentlemen, nice to be with you.
Yeah, happy to have you on board with us here. And I mentioned being introduced to the game by your dad. That's a theme that we've heard repeatedly throughout our trainer talk shows over the past several months.
Yeah, you know, at a very young age, you know, we moved back to my dad's hometown when I was 8 years old, and our neighbor was a family that had racehorses, and their father was a trainer, and there were three boys, and I kind of grew up around them, and my dad went on to own a horse at the track, and then one turned into more than one and bred a few horses. So, yeah, that was my introduction to it.
And as you're growing up with that, you've obviously made several trips to the track. What captured your thoughts about racing and maybe thinking about being a trainer?
You know, as I was young, I mean, you know, I was raised pretty much out in the country, so I guess enjoy the country life. You know, and again, I was exposed to racehorses at a young age. I really enjoyed first going to the track with my dad on weekends, and especially when he had something running. And, you know, it's funny, with technology has changed, it was a big deal for us to get the audio tape of the race or to listen to the race on the radio. So, you know, it's something that I enjoyed at a young age. And when I was about 14, I had a conference with our guidance counselor. We're getting ready to go in high school, 13, 14. And, you know, the usual questions and what classes you should take going into high school. And, you know, he asked me, you know, what do you think you want to do when you grow up? And it was something that I probably, like anyone else, hadn't given a lot of thought. And I just said, you know, I think I might train racehorses. And I'm not really sure why I said it, but I always thought that I would own horses. And I went home that evening and a discussion with my dad about it. And boy, he got ticked off. He was like, you got to be kidding me. You never it's ridiculous, and you know, you don't know how difficult it is going to be to make a living. And he was right. I grew up around Finger Lakes, and but from that moment on, I knew what I wanted to do. So it's kind of been blinkers on my whole life, and you know, very fortunate that I can do something and get up every morning and that I have a passion for.
What was the reaction from your guidance counselor when you told them?
My guidance counselor was a guy by the name of Ed Bugliosi. And I had Mr. Bugliosi was a guidance counselor. I'm not sure what he might have taught. And I had a math teacher by the name of Pete Webster, and another teacher who was our high school basketball coach by the name of Pete Herman. And if you know Pete was the head coach, was a coach, assistant coach at Western Kentucky with Dennis Felton, and he was at Georgia before that, and Navy, and he's now at Young Harris, Georgia. But those three guys loved to go to the races. And so I always had a very close bond with them. And Ed has passed away since, but Pete Webster and Pete Herman, I stay very close in touch with. And you know, it's interesting as a kid that I had a certain bond with them in a different way than school. And to this day, you know, they're all still big racing fans.
Yeah, it's great when you grow up in that type of atmosphere and have those kind of mentors to show you the ropes and you know, hang out at the track with.
Yeah, it's you know, it's fun. It was just, you know, it's been a pleasure to me to, you know, retain those relationships, you know, with some of the people from back home. You know, I moved away from there. You know, I've been in New York the last 28 years. Yeah, but to form those relationships and I guess for them to appreciate, you know, kind of where I've, you know, where I came from, or, you know, where I've gotten to.
Kind of like the David Dunk marching in chowder society, as Vince Gully might say.
Yeah.
David, what was your first job on the racetrack?
You know, typical, like everybody else, you know, walking horses, cleaning stalls. I mean, it's a little different, you know, brought up at a small track in Finger Lakes. And if we had 30 horses, you know, we had four or five people working there, and you kind of did it all. You walked horses, you cleaned stalls. Everybody had their duty, whether, you know, learning to do up horses. And again, for me, it started on weekends. You know, I remember when I turned 16, it was typical then, like it is today, you couldn't be licensed on the track till you're 16. So, you know, my birthday is the end of May. And when I turned 16, I knew that, you know, it's a big deal for me that I was going to be able to get my license and work there for the summer. But it was more like working on a farm. You kind of did everything. It's not where here, let's say in New York, where a groom rubs three, four, five horses and everybody just has specific duties. And we basically did everything but ride them. And, you know, so it's, you learned how to work because you weren't overstaffed. You were probably understaffed. You had a hot walking machine that helped you with the horses and, you know, putting horses on the machine. But it was good. It was a great atmosphere. Very low key, you know, and, you know, it's a great education, you know, that led me to get to another level.
Well, and then you had the opportunity to work for not just any trainer, but Hall of Fame trainer Woody Stevens, and that had to be just an amazing experience.
Yeah, you know, I tell you, I trained for 5 years at Finger Lakes first, and mainly for my dad. And I went to Florida one winter for the first time. I'd never been away, and I went to Gulfstream and really went there. A friend of mine set me up with somebody with Jim Levitch from Chicago, and I rubbed horses. And later in the spring, I got a call from a mutual friend, Bill Wilmot, who lives in Saratoga. And he was very good friends with Sandy Bruno, who worked for Woody. And Phil had left. Phil Gleese was just leaving and to go on his own. And there was an opening. And you know, Billy called me and told me about it and told me to go see Sandy. And, you know, so I knew at that point in my career that I needed to do something else. I was at Finger Lakes, but I just felt that if I was going to be better at what I was doing, I need to go somewhere else. And, you know, I just, the biggest break of, you know, my career to this day is getting a job. Sandy hired me, and, you know, two weeks later, I went to work, and I just called my dad and said, I'm not coming back home. But, yeah, it was an unbelievable opportunity.
When you had the chance to be part of the final two Belmont victories with Woody Stevens, I know you worked with 49er and Danzig Connection and Stefan's Odyssey. I mean, when you look at the horses you were around and that experience that you were able to gain, it just, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, I tell you, he was everything you hear about him, and all of us, you know, that are a little older that was exposed to him. I always say that he loved the game. He ate it, he drank it, he slept it. And he, and that was later in his career. But I would have stayed there 20 years. I was there 5.5 years till his health forced him to reduce the size of the stable. But, you know, being exposed to those kind of horses, Creme Fraiche, Lock It, Gone West, add a few more, to those kind of owners, you know, I was playing, helping on a team, let's say, that was at, you know, the biggest level. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful man. And, it was a great pleasure. I would have stayed a long time. But at the same time, it helped me get to where I am today.
What was the most important thing you learned in working with Woody that you still incorporate today?
Well, you know, every day there's always things that, you know, that happen when you watch a horse. And, I think one of the things for me that really helps, and I look at someone like even Todd that was around Lucas and stuff, that when you're around a lot of good horses, sometimes you happen to notice it early. I always say, like, there's a checklist, and you just start checking all the boxes, you know, the demeanor, how much class they have, just certain things that the horses do in the shed row, whether it's just in the stall, whether you're watching them cool out. It doesn't just have to be training wise. And then if you come across horses that are pretty decent horses, I think that you're not overwhelmed by it, because you don't treat them any different than you do the lower rung horses in the stable. You know, every horse is the same. Every horse is probably on the same feeding program. He loved to talk, as we all know, about his horses and good horses, and just all of those experiences, the negative and positives of those things. And he had a sixth sense. I think experience, you know, the older we get, you just become much more confident in what you do. Not afraid to make a decision. I think the older we get, the much more patient, just like we do in regular life, we become much, much more patient. And I think that's what I saw him, you know, late in his career. People would like to say, especially training has changed in the aspect that I think that we all don't run them as much. Everyone's afraid to run them. I think they're afraid to get them beat, and maybe they don't train as much. I don't think they trained that hard. He just had really, really good horses. And, there's a lot of quotes he gave us, but, he'd tell you, a loaded gun will go off in anybody's hand. A good horse makes up for all riders and trainers' mistakes.
Yeah, there's no question about that. You know, it seems like today there's the youth movement, and I think everything that you've said about Woody, also applies to guys like Alan Jerkins, and that you've just got to be a better trainer the older you are and the more experience that you have. Yet, you know, owners seem to gravitate to the next young guy that comes up and wins, you know, five races in his first 10 starts. I don't quite understand that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because a lot of owners that come in the game, you know, in the last 15, 20 years have made a lot of money doing something else, and they're young themselves. But I think you're correct. I mean, I'm 53 today, and I'll have horses in the barn. I can go down the shed row. And, you know, I would say that, you know, if I make some right moves that 15, 20 years ago, I would have made the wrong move. I would have been a little bit impatient. Maybe I wouldn't have had as much confidence in the decision that I made. I think it's like anything. Experience is priceless. So, yeah, I think that's true. Just like Woody, you know, I mean, I was there, you know, and he was in his 70s, and my God, and he won 5 Belmonts in a row. And he had a lot of good horses before that. You know, you can go back to the Bald Eagle years and whatnot in the late 50s and early 60s when he trained for Captain Guggenheim. But at the same time, you know, late in his career, you just see people come across, you know, have good horses and do very well with them. And, you know, I think part of it is you're not overwhelmed by the situation. So you do see a lot of it. Unfortunately, maybe somebody has to make a mistake a bit and learn. But yeah, that's maybe a little bit the way the game is today.
Trainer David Donk joining us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. David, one word you mentioned a short time ago was the word patience. And there was one horse in particular that you had to be patient with. And I only say that because he raced until he was 8 years old and he made 70 starts. And that's a horse that I know has to be very special to you. And that's a Wad.
Yeah. You know, a lot of credit goes, again, probably, you know, the longer that I go doing this is, you know, working for Woody, because one thing working with someone like that, you're dealing with, you know, the pedigree aspect of it. And Woody trained, you know, Caveat, Cannonade, Bold Bitter, you know, and then a Wad Sire with Caveat. And I just knew that when I had him early on, that, you know, what his style was probably going to be like, and being around Woody, some of the, you know, horses being patient. You know, the story is, when Tinkai rode Caveat, you know, he just told Pint Luffy, you know, when you get him as far back as you can get him, take him back 5 more lengths. And I think it was, again, not afraid to take a horse back and know that, you know, that's what that horse wanted to do. And obviously early on, we learned that's what a Wad wanted to do. A lot of credit goes to Eddie Maple. And I think because Eddie rode for Woody, that he trusted him. And I remember one time I had Pat Day on him in California for the first time, and nobody had more patience than Pat Day. And I said, Pat, you know, this horse is, you know, basically suits your style, but you just got to be really patient, and he's got a short run. And he came back, and the horse ran well. Obviously, he didn't win a lot of his starts. He needed pace, you know, but Pat came back and said, wow, I know what you mean now. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, this guy can say that to me. But a lot of credit goes for me being around Woody and, you know, being around the pedigree you know, and trusting him.
Well, Awad was a personal favorite of mine. I loved watching him run. I loved following his career. What made him stand out to you when you first got him?
You know, when we got him, he was just, you know, your typical two-year-old. I mean, he was a nice balanced horse. You know, training for Jim Ryan, for Rye Hill, who, you know, very fortunate for. I was exposed, you know, being around him with Woody. And, you know, early on, he wasn't really difficult. He was quite studdish. And he was studdish in a way that he just liked to scream a lot. He always, he would intimidate people. Wasn't a big, strong horse, but he was very athletic. And early on, as a two-year-old, there were no opportunities to run on the grass like there are now. And he ran, I believe he made 3 starts. The first time I ran him for a claim and price at Belmont, he got beat. Didn't hit the board. I ran up a couple of 7/8 in Saratoga on the dirt. Didn't hit the board. And then I ran him. He ran a maiden turf race at Belmont when we got back. We were pretty sure that that's what he wanted to do. The dam side said grass. And he got beat by Sea Hero and Halsey in a maiden race. And I had another horse at the time for Alan DeGroen called Dr. Elfus, who had won on the had placed in the summer stakes in Canada. So the Pilgrim came up, and I'm going to run Mr. Dragone's horse, and Jim Ryan said to me, you know, geez, I wouldn't mind running in the Pilgrim. Just even if he got a check, that'd be great. And I ran both horses and finished 1-2, and a wad broke his mane in the Pilgrim. So, you know, early on, we thought he was grass, and once he did that, you know, I knew he was going to be a pretty useful horse, but obviously didn't know at the time that I was going to be able to go on and have as much fun and success and be able to travel the world as we were able with them.
Well, it was an exciting time in the Dunk stable sometime around the mid-90s there, because not only did you have a wad, but then along came Ordway, who was a very, very promising juvenile. He finished third in the 96 Breeders' Cup Juvenile. Talk about him and what he meant to your operation at that time.
Yeah, you know, it was the first year that, you know, I trained a horse or two for Bill Punk and Phil DeLeo, and they bought him out of a yearling sale, and I got him, and, you know, he ran a nice race first time out. God, I want to say Boston Harbor beat him. They ended up winning the Breeders' Cup at Belmont, and broke his maiden in Saratoga, was second in the hopeful, came back to win the Champagne, you know, which was a big deal, which was a lot of fun, and obviously you get noticed if you have two-year-olds and something of quality. Finished third in the Breeders' Cup, you know, with probably a big green runner and around the two turns the first time. You know, and to this day, had a lot of horses for Bill and Phil, and, you know, they owned Hessenite. So it's been a great relationship.
As I was reading through your bio, David, I noticed there was one other horse that people may not be as familiar with as Ordway and Awad, but that's Courageous Comet. And I thought that this was a really cool story. Tell us about Courageous Comet and what happened there.
Yeah, Courageous Comet was a New York bred by Comet Shine, and we bought him out of a yearling sale, New York bred. Didn't pay that much for him, 25,000-30,000 maybe, and he was a useful horse. He was a pretty gray horse, real nice balance, beautiful mover, and he ended up being stakes placed in one of the Stallion Stakes. I'm going to say later it was in a three-year-old year maybe, but we sent him to Finger Lakes, and someone had noticed him, I guess, one day cooling out. The next time he was in, they claimed him for $10,000, which was a good price at the time. And I believe it's Becky Holder that has him, and went on to be a prominent event horse, show horse, and competed in the Rolex there in Kentucky and whatnot. So he went on to be a very good event horse, but he was a very attractive gray and was a nice mover. So I guess to some degree, it doesn't surprise me that he was able to go on and do that.
Yeah, I actually finished second at Rolex Kentucky in the 3-day event, and then that earned him a trip to Hong Kong for the Olympics. So pretty neat story there with Courageous Comet.
Yeah, it's a fantastic event, Rolex, and to finish second is no easy task, that's for sure.
David, what do people maybe not know about David Dunk that we could tell them? What do you like to do outside of the racetrack? What other hobbies do you have?
Well, listen, I love to watch, typically like most racetrackers, I love to watch all sports, whether it's basketball, football, baseball, even college and pro. I love to play golf. I like to say that I'm a typical American golfer, that I'm not any good. I'd like to say that I'd love to. Golf is a game that I'd love to play and then train the rest of the day and into the evening, but our lifestyle doesn't allow that. But, you know, I've got two kids. You know, I like to say that I get to enjoy it more because I'm a little older. You know, so I'm 53, but at the same time, I don't feel 53, but I guess the number is creeping up. You know, but it just, I really enjoy watching the racing across the country, especially on a weekend, and the availability of simulcast signals and just all sports. Pretty much just like to stay on top of it. Obviously, living in New York, it's a big deal, and you know, there's a lot of radio, a lot of TV, very easy to stay up on everything. So it's, you're kind of in the mainstream, I think, and you're able to follow, as an example, NFL. It's quite easy to follow every team. It's not directed, even though you have two New York teams, it's very easy to follow the exposure of the sport in New York and follow everyone's.
Is it Yankees or Mets for you?
You know, pretty much Yankees. Always basically grew up that way. And I love to see the Mets play well. I learned early on, I'm a New York Jets fan, and I learned when I was young, don't get hung up on your team and be such a diehard fan, because you're going to get crushed more than your dream, and then you're going to be successful. An interesting thing about sports for me is I love to watch, and I guess attribute it to training, good managers and good coaches. And there might even be a team that I don't like per se, but as they become successful, I think I become very respectful of the coaches or managers and the job that they do. And it's so much different, I guess, in pro sports and college sport to gain the respect of the players. And so I love to watch good coaching.
One thing I know about David Donk that probably not too many people know about is that I ran an auction for the Whittingham family of Charlie Whittingham's estate. And David Donk was one of the few trainers that actually bought something from the auction. I believe you bought a Webbing, David. Is that true? Did you buy a Webbing or tack box?
I have a groom box.
A tack box. Okay. Yeah.
I have a tack box that I gave to a very good friend of mine. But I have a photo too. And I don't think I bought it in the auction. I might have bought it elsewhere. But I have a Charlie Whittingham photo that Neil Drysdale is the assistant trainer in. So I have some memorabilia of Woody. It was interesting because around Sandy, we always got the steak pictures and we had him sign a lot of stuff. And I'm always kind of on the lookout, even older stuff that was before me, you know, because he was around so many good horses. I'm going to tell you, an item I bought years ago on eBay was an original 1974 Derby racing form. And that was the year Cannonade won the Derby for Woody, the 100th running. So stuff like that, yeah. But, you know, those guys like that, like Charlie Whittingham, obviously I got to meet him, especially the year that he came with Ferdinand and Danzig Connection and John's Treasure with Walter Kelly. You know, those are memories that, you know, you cherish. And I knew that I went to work for Woody where I came from, that I was working for a legend in his own time. So I really soaked it up. I really enjoyed it. And I was very fortunate that it was 5.5 years, but I would have stayed 20. It was a lot of fun. And obviously, it was one of the best universities I could have gone to.
Well, David, this half hour has really flown by. Just about time to wrap this one up, but I want to thank you for being with us here on Trainer Talk tonight. It's always a lot of fun to hear the stories of all of the trainers that we talk with, and yours is certainly unique, and we appreciate you being here. All of our guests who appear on the program receive gifts from EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strips, so we'll take care of you and get those to you. And again, appreciate you being with us tonight, and best of luck moving forward.
Thank you very much, guys. I really appreciate it.
All right, Trainer David Donk, wrapping up a fun show here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton this evening. Reed Baker was with us in the first half of the program. If you missed any of the interview with Reed or David telling his story, you can go to our website later on. There will be a podcast available, as there are with all of our Trainer Talk shows. You can do that at horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes.
Well worth it. That was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
Good guys, both of them.
And interesting that David, usually when we ask that question, what do you like to do outside of the racetrack? The standard answer from most of the trainers we talk with is, well, all I do is the racetrack.
Yeah.
And that's it. And it was interesting to hear that David actually has a few other things he likes to get into. Reed, too, I guess, training chickens.
Yeah. Maybe Reed more than David.
Yeah, we should have asked David. I said that. We should have asked David if he had ever trained chickens before. Or
Well, I think it's good for horse trainers to have a little bit of a diversion. You know, it can get to you being at the barn 24 hours a day.
Well, you know, you did it for 20 years.
I certainly did.
All right, don't forget tomorrow we're back 3 to 7 Eastern time. This hour from 6 to 7 will be our BristNet.com call-in show, your chance to talk some racing with Ed DeRosa from Brist and Chad Summers and Sean Feld, our entire team. And then on Friday, 3 to 7 Eastern time, our Express Bet Weekend Stakes preview. Get you ready for all the big racing action this weekend, and you will hear all the racing from Santa Anita and Belmont. 6 hours of coverage Saturday afternoon with us on HRN. You can visit our website, horseracingradio.net, for a complete broadcast schedule and all of that information at horseracingradio.net. Our thanks to Reed Baker and to David Donk for being with us on Trainer Talk tonight, presented by Fasic Tipton. For Lee Delapina, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening.
Good night, Barbados.